You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
So, Kaifu, I so much enjoyed this AI 2041. What a brilliant idea of basically taking a well-known science fiction author, Chen Qifan. Is that how you say his name? Qifan?
Qifan.
And author of Waste Tide. I feel like there's been, in the past 10 years, 15 years, maybe it's just the translations have been happening, but there's this huge wave of like brilliant science fiction written in China lately, you know, and I don't even know if people know, like movies like Arrival were originally, I think that was a Ken Liu story. And so you decided to go this route of not just examining AI from this academic point of view. And of course, I've known you for a long time. You're an AI genius in every possible way, but you didn't just write some boring textbook. You took all these very interesting questions about how AI could change the near future. You took a great science fiction writer, joined forces with them, and he basically wrote up these scenarios and gave them life and gave the characters life. They're beautiful stories, well-written and well done. It's a page-turning book as a science fiction collection of stories, but it also raises all these really interesting questions of AI. How did this project come to be? It's very unique.
Yeah, it was an idea from my company. You know, our day job is a venture capital, but our marketing team has a couple of people who know that I have this love to express myself. And I wanted to write another book. I felt my last book, AI Superpowers, was reasonably popular and perhaps because it was readable, but I had reached my abilities in readability. And if I wanted the ideas about AI to be better understood, I needed to partner with someone who could be much better than me in storytelling. And so we found Qifan.
Yeah, because he really, like, it's very easy to say, this is what could happen with AI insurance. But it's another thing when you give characters decisions in their life are made by well-written characters, and so you feel what they're feeling, that their love life might be affected, or that, you know, their career decisions, or, you know, and you know, in terms of the monarch who's looking for some sort of contentment or enlightenment in the question of what is happiness. These are not, once it's written by an author, it's fiction really is the truth told with lies. And so it's a way of telling this truth that we all relate to, even if it's through a fictional character. And so it makes you really think, wow, that could happen to me. And so, I mean, so let's start going through some of these questions that you raise, and I won't give away any plot secrets or anything, but let's talk about the AI insurance one, which is the very first story, where basically a family's insurance rates are modified depending on how much data they give the insurance company. And of course, you could see almost in real time how decisions they make affect insidiously their insurance rates.
Right, right. I mean, people read a lot about, you know, Cambridge Analytica and how evil that is. But actually, AI's power is that it can take into consideration so many things, you know, tens of thousands of features, and then use it to influence us. And you could think that it's trying to be benign, right? If you think about an insurance company, their goals are ostensibly aligned with ours. They want us to be healthy. We want to be healthy. And they give us reward for doing good things to be healthy. What could possibly go wrong? So the story tells a particular situation where a particular person's loved interest is perceived by AI to be bad for her. And then it tries to do all kinds of things to obstruct that love story from developing. So, you know, from an AI standpoint, it's trying to minimize your risk of, problems to your health. And it ought to be good for you, but it's actually hurting our, you know, freedom of choice. So it shows that their AI's ability to reason based on tens of thousands of features and has ways to essentially help us, but also manipulate us, needs to be cautiously monitored, and we need to do things to minimize the negative effect while maximizing its power.
Yeah, and it's very interesting because this is in some ways explores the issues of literally systemic, and I'm putting systemic in quotes, systemic racism. And I hate to use that phrase because it's not really well-defined, but it's almost more defined in the context in this book where an actual system might not know it's making decisions based on race or demographics or whatever, but it might turn out, for instance, that if I marry someone who's 20 years younger than me, I'm just saying, if a man marries someone who's 20 years hypothetically younger, it could be the case that is very much anti-longevity for that person. Who knows? I'm just making up these statistics. But just when you share your conversation with the insurance, and this becomes an issue in the story where the girl decides to share her actual conversations that she's having, the AI knows intimately, literally, what you're interested in romantically and how that could affect, you know, based on the statistics it has, your longevity or your career choices or your opportunities in life or your the chances you're going to be homeless, and adjust your insurance accordingly.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad you like this story. It is kind of an extension of the documentary Social Dilemma, which a lot of people watched. But I think people understood, okay, how, you know, Google and Amazon could do things to try to make more money because their goals are not aligned with yours. They're trying to make money. We're trying to search for content or, you know, browse my friends' posts or buy something. It's not aligned. Therefore, AI can twist things because it has different goals than you. So this story attempts to show that even if your goals are very well aligned, AI is so smart, it will take very small hints. And in this story, actually, the data has been cleansed so that the racial information is not there, but yet it's still inferred and made it into a factor. So it is intended as a double warning on the potential dangers of AI. And you know, the story was a little controversial because some people read it and said, well, where's the science fiction? But I felt the 10 stories needed to be developed from the most basic, what is already here today, and then to the most advanced, so that people can essentially get a course, a layman's course on AI. So we started out, and Qiufan was brilliant in taking what is a plain story, an extension of Social Dilemma, and really turned it into a dramatically interesting.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because for some of these stories, the technology exists now to do this.
Right.
Like to
right.
do, if I, for instance, carried around some sort of recorder and recorded all of my actual conversations during the day with people, insurance companies or marketing companies or anything could have a field day with that. Like if I start saying to my friends, that's a nice car over there. Who knows? Maybe if it's a red car that I pointed at, maybe my insurance rates go down. But yeah. I mean, my insurance rates go up because red cars have more accidents. But maybe car salesmen call me. Like, and I feel with a lot of these technology issues, it's always very good intentions. Like you even point out in the story, you know, lives are being saved by lower insurance rates when people share their data. But you can't really regulate goodness. So good intentions, whether it's from a business or from a government, is going to have some downside. It's unforeseen. And that's what the case with all of these stories here.
Yeah. And actually, there is another story that talks about people who kind of figured out how the AI worked so that they talk in a way so as to trick the AI into thinking they're good. So it could go the other way as well.
Well, you know, so this comes up, and maybe you're referring to the story about deepfakes and how, again, this is a technology that exists now where you could take any video and put anybody's face on it and give that person speech and have it, the AI lip sync so that the face looks normal. And that's a deepfake video. It's very hard to, and it gets more and more complicated as software is developed to detect deepfake videos. Other software is developed often hand in hand to develop even more advanced deepfake videos. These adversarial neural networks that you talk about in the book. And by the way, I should mention you do a very good job describing the AI in between each chapter. And it's like a less, like you say, it's like a masterclass in AI combined with these beautifully written stories. But I feel like in the long run, it does paint a bleak picture. It's always good intentions, but we have no hope ultimately of detecting, you know, in the long run, deep fake AI or virtual reality that is indistinguishable from the real world and so on.
Well, it's kind of like virus software and antivirus. In that case, I think the good guys largely won because the large data collected and the instant updating essentially suppressed the virus problem for the great, great majority of the people, with a small percentage of victims whose being victimized becomes data and hint to prevent other people from becoming victimized. Deepfake is, as you said, a lot harder because it's kind of a competition on who's got more compute power. It's the same technology that can detect the fakeness that can also be used in turn to make the fakeness more real. So it's a competition of who's got more compute power. The problem is the good guys have to defend against all fakes. The bad guys just have to make one fake really, really hard to detect. So it does paint a bleak picture if you extrapolate without a breakthrough in technology. So that's why in the tech explanation, I also showed at least one way that if we actually use blockchain technology that authenticates every picture as when it was captured, that could someday lead to the fact that at least we can show whether a picture or a photo or a video has ever been altered since this time of capture. Of course, that's not the panacea necessarily, but it's also only one way. So I'd like to still hope there are new technologies that can solve the problem. But you're very much right that based on the current adversarial technology, GANs, it does seem like the good guys won't be able to usually, or at least certainly not always, catch the bad guys differently from the antivirus situation.
Now, you know, I want to skip ahead to one of the later stories, but I don't want to give any stories away. But what do you see as the future of money and how it relates to AI? Like, this is a very interesting discussion.
And you mentioned
blockchain.
Yeah, so I think that actually becomes more of a social question and a anthropological questions rather than a technology question. It seems like, logically speaking, one of the things I'm predicting for the future is that if you think about, you know, why was money ever invented? It is so that products which are in increasing levels of scarcity can be priced so that they can be bartered and exchanged among people. However, there is a trend now accelerating that is causing products to be made for lower and lower prices. And that comes from three parts. One is materials revolution, that scientists can build new materials out of lower cost and greener materials, one molecule at a time. Second is an energy revolution, where the cost of energy will plummet as the improvements in solar and battery storage improves. And the third is that the labor will become almost free as automation and robots take over the production of goods. So if you combine these three trends and project towards something close to a post-scarcity world, then if in an altruistic society, if most things can be made for almost for free, then it seems like the good thing is poverty and hunger ought to go away, and that the need for money becomes less important because you would only use money to buy things that are truly scarce, like a Van Gogh painting or something like that. But then there is the thousands of years habit that we have of collecting money, saving money. Money is a status symbol, money as an object of desire, and money as a way to compete against each other for ego and power. And also companies have been known to create artificial scarcity, like diamonds are not really scarce, but De Beers chooses to only mine a small percentage a year and then do marketing to make it desirable and scarce. So can we actually get there, the road towards eradication of hunger and poverty, that all people can live a respectable life despite our bad habits and despite the historical record that that companies, private companies, don't behave well when it comes to the costs of their products plummeting, that they're more inclined to convince people that their product is still scarce and worth a lot of money, even when it's not.
Right. And so, you know, people talk about how they use almost an old-fashioned way of looking at economics, like, okay, money supply has been printed, and so there's going to be inflation. But I think people have not really, economists in particular, have not factored in that the extreme rise in productivity, first from the internet and now in particular from AI, has reduced wage pressures considerably across almost every industry. I mean, you could start off with the IT industry. There was no more need for network engineers because it's all the internet protocol. But then you're going to take it all the way up to blockchain and money and, you know, projects developed with Ethereum and then projects developed with AI for instance, insurance or scanning, you know, x-rays or driving cars or planes or whatever. So there's going to be high-end jobs eliminated or at least moved around. And this puts a huge deflationary pressure on the world economy.
Absolutely. And, you know, in fact, most economic theories will become outdated as the idea of scarcity slowly goes away. But yet, I think, you know, we've had hundreds of years built on these economic theories, whether you're a believer in, you know, Adam Smith or Keynesian or Marxists, they're all based on the idea that products are increasingly scarce. And when that idea is gone, we really do need a new theory, and also along with it, a new way to motivate people. because many people live for the job or the status or the wealth that they have, but yet all of those are being radically shifted in the next 20 years or so.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a three-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a three-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You have a story, the job savior, and the word savior is very appropriate here because if you think about it, throughout history, man has been not only on a quest for food and security and safety, but also on a quest for meaning. We rise up in our tribe based on our ability to find meaning and then fulfill that meaning, to execute on that meaning in our lives. And like you mentioned, job and even money as a sign of status, these are often ways we have found meaning in modern society, in a secular society. You know, as AI displaces more and more of the things we've spent hundreds of years specializing in, what do you see as our quest for meaning? How does that change? And you deal with this in several stories.
Yes. So I think the general theme that I try to promote is that of Maslow hierarchy, that our meaning needs to evolve from the base levels of survival and then subsistence up towards love and connectivity and then dignity and respect and then self-actualization. So that we, there are multiple ways of getting there. I think one is basically create more jobs and opportunities that connect us to each other, because after all, that is one unique aspect of people, that we have feelings and love and trust that cannot be replaced by machine and AI. Another is through some artificial mechanism like money that encourages us to move in that direction. And then there is a possibility that people can really follow their passion and essentially earn their respect and equivalent of wealth without having to do a job that has an economic value to the society, whether it is homeschooling your children or providing service to a foster home or elderly home, or doing a job in a virtual world, which has no economic value other than one, to keep you satisfied that you are contributing, even when you may not be. But secondly, to sharpen your skills so that you can become someone who's good at the job. So the question that we try to solve in that story, Job Savior, is that if AI is taking all the routine jobs, basic jobs away, then all the entry-level accountant jobs are gone, but senior financial people are still needed. Basic paralegal jobs are gone, but experienced lawyers are still needed. But how does a lawyer, an accountant, financial analyst ever become a superstar unless they had the training at a base level? So the idea is that people can work in a virtual community in a basic level and essentially be watched by AI for those who have talent, then they can be elevated to higher status, while most of the people will continue to do work that they think contributes value, but actually AI can do a better job and perhaps they can work together and perhaps some people's work are just thrown away and AI will redo it, but kind of create a sense that they're contributing. So these are all the ideas. I don't know which ones will work. There are other people who would suggest that the time has come for a new religion. And that might be another path, but one way or another, we're going to have to deal with this drastic shift in what has motivated us for the last 1,000 years, may no longer be around to motivate us.
Yeah. Because, you know, you mentioned Maslow's hierarchy, but even parts of that hierarchy could be outsourced to AI. So for instance, Let's just, I'm just going to take hypothetically friendship, but it could apply to romance. I could record all the conversations I have for the next year, and then I could label them. This conversation made me feel good. This conversation made me not feel good. And, you know, an AI could kind of break out semantically the characteristics of the paragraphs or conversations or people that made me feel good versus not feel good. And the technology to make a virtual friend will become better and better. And that's not so far-fetched, even with today's technology, with like GPT-3 and so on. I mean, I feel like they're almost holding back fully releasing that technology for these reasons.
Well, I think what you just described, what could be a nice story in a book that you could write. I think the measure of your happiness, actually what you describe is very likely to be doable. And it doesn't even have to require you to label what made you happy.
Right, because it knows in the brain, oh, dopamine just got released. So let's have these conversations in the morning and these in the evening when serotonin are released.
Exactly. So the hormones, which are just scratching the surface, and much more brain science will help understand what stimulates us and make us happy. And also simple things like watching our facial expression, what the police profilers are very good at doing. And AI can do a much, much better job in watching micro expressions. These are expressions that are microseconds and not usually detectable by normal people, but AI can detect it. Might be a flicker of a particular way you blink or a particular way your eyes look at a particular direction, or maybe humidity. Maybe we're sweating. Maybe our pupils are dilating. So AI could be watching all of that and learning to make us happy. Again, something that sounds good because we want to be happy. But then are we moving towards a world where AI controls us and we become mere puppets? So that's the double-edged sword.
But it's a real interesting thing. So in the study of positive psychology, they don't use the word happiness, they use the word well-being. And it consists of three components, you know, according to this field of positive psychology. One is community. So how closely do you interact and positively do you interact with your community? Mastery. So how people feel good when they get better at a skill, whether it's a skill that makes money or a game like tennis or whatever. And the third one is, it's escaping me right now, but I brought it up because I wanted to talk about mastery for a second. And you have a story on AI-based education. It seems like an AI-based education is, again, doable now, and we haven't even begun to look into this. Like, imagine learning the piano. An AI is going to be much more in tune with, did he just play the scales correctly? And could then modify the exercises as such to hone in on what scales did I mess up, or how am I not, it could optimize the exercises so that whatever weaknesses it spots in my play, it could optimize them on a minute by minute basis and change the exercises and challenge me in different ways until it finally starts giving me pieces. And then I could understand, where am I going wrong? Where am I not feeling the emotion? Where am I not, you know, where am I just 1/16th of a second off? So I feel like AI-based learning, we're in inning zero, but that's going to be a huge component in terms of well-being, because we love getting good at things.
I think the field of education can be significantly improved by AI. A lot of what teachers do, AI can do better. And that includes both the ability to detect areas in which a student might need to help. And as you know, in classes, sometimes students are far advanced of where the class is going and wanted to go faster. Other students want to go slower. And AI allows for a personalized, targeted tutor training lesson class that's exactly at the speed you need, and also making up for anything that you may be falling behind so that you can continue your growth. For example, if you need more multiplication drills before you can learn division, it will give that to you, whereas in a class, it cannot. It can also detect when a student is maybe not paying attention and dozing off, and then it needs to find new ways. It can also appeal to a student's preference. So that to a student who loves basketball, then all the math questions can be recast in basketball and sports or Olympics or and also maybe even if for another student who loves superheroes, then he or she can become a superhero playing a game while learning math at the same time. So I feel all of this can go such a long way, and it doesn't at all impact the need for human teachers. Because as you mentioned, there's a community, that there is the need for students to learn how to communicate, to win trust, to make friends, to persuade. And that can only be taught with people-to-people environments and practices that could be led by a teacher who is not about one-to-many teaching, but about creating scenarios in which learning can take place. And of course, there are things like igniting the curiosity, critical thinking, and creativity. So teachers will become essentially catalysts to move students in those directions and providing a personal coaching that connects to the student. So arguably, you'll need even more teachers, but they may be more like mentor coaches, less like domain experts giving lectures.
Yeah, it's good. I feel like, I mean, obviously this was great material for fiction, but I feel this is great material for understanding what businesses to start looking at in the near future. And by near future, I mean five years, say, to start. Like, for instance, this idea of AI education being very catered to my individual actions and motions and exercises and so on. I feel, again, there's some foreign language, you know, applications that already do this, but, you know, learning foreign languages, but learning piano, learning, a sport, learning more nuanced, even creative things, which people enjoy to learn. I don't think that we're even in inning one of this yet, and that this is a multi-trillion-dollar market.
I think so. It has some challenges because education is one of the elements of our society that is most resistant to change. If you think about, imagine what entertainment was like 100 years ago versus today. Imagine what communication work was 100 years ago versus today. They've completely been revolutionized. But education still largely takes place around the world as a one teacher giving lectures to many students, because that's proven to work. And it's understandable why people are conservative about education, because it's a product that doesn't get measured for, you know, something like 15, 20 years. You only then do you know whether it has worked, whether kids who went through this education ended up becoming positive contributors to society. So people are very hesitant to change education. So on the one hand, I agree with you, AI is so ready for such a big change. On the other hand, the conservative aspect of society, people's resistance to change education, I think may stifle its growth. But we'll see.
And also, there's issues with raising children. So let's say you want your child to be a violin prodigy, and so now instead of hiring a coach 1 hour a week, you could have 24/7. An AI coach, you know, where you say, you know, get back to work on the violin. You know, you have more exercise. The AI says you have 27,000 exercises to do.
And so hopefully that AI will also detect when the parents' dream are not either realizable, or that the child may have some other passion that's more suitable. And say, okay, we're going to try to coach you in some other direction that fits your interests.
All of this borders on good intentions or insidious.